Today we're going to be breaking down 1 Peter 3:15 into four parts, as you can see color-coded on the screen, which reads, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." Now this, in Greek, is in the imperative mood, meaning that we as Christians are commanded to be able to give a defense of the faith that we have. So walking through this, we're going to hit the four main points: what it means to sanctify Jesus as Lord in our hearts, something to be able to give you a defense of that faith. People should be asking about our changed lives, and doing it all with gentleness and reverence. Now, okay, first point: to sanctify is to set apart or to make holy. And to sanctify Jesus as Lord in one's heart needs to hold him in such high regard with all due reverence and awe. His enthronement upon our hearts and our lives should be what we're utmost concerned with. And, of course, our obedience would follow with that. Now, this epistle by Peter was written during a time where persecution was very heavy in the church. And the beginning of this verse uses the word "but," which links it back to the previous verse, which says, "Do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled," making this mean don't be tormented by fear of what your enemies will do to you, but only be concerned with enthroning Jesus upon your heart. Now, while we might not face the same kind of persecution that they did back then, we still face some kind of scrutiny as Christians. And as you enthrone Jesus on your heart, you can be assured that nothing will disturb you. Jesus would put it this way in Matthew 10:28: "Do not fear those who kill the body but are unable to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell." So while we might not face the same persecution, we certainly get things. But we don't have to fear what people say. We don't have to fear what skeptics of Christianity will say. We don't have to fear their science or the PhDs or the philosophy. First Peter would later write, "We did not follow cleverly devised tales, but were eyewitnesses to his majesty." And as we'll see here in a minute, the evidence is very much on our side. Which leads me to my next point, is being always ready to make a defense. So the Greek word for the phrase "always being ready to make a defense" is apologia, which might sound familiar. It's where we get our English word apologetics, which is, of course, meaning reasoned arguments in justification of a religion or religious doctrine. Despite being a command, as stated earlier, many Christians, when a non-believer says, you know, there's no evidence for a supreme being, or, you know, resurrections and miracles are fairy tales, many believers aren't able to present anything back to them. And it's not as we need to have a big memorized speech. Oftentimes, just a few lines of evidence like this will suffice. And this is not all the evidence for God, by the way. But we're going to examine the first four of these, that being: God is the best explanation for the beginning of the universe, the apparent fine-tuning of the universe, the evidence that took place to Jesus of Nazareth, and personal experiences with God. So, despite the fact that you don't need to have a huge sermon memorized when somebody asks you, it is important to be able to give a logical and reasonable reason for believing, or as Peter would put it, the hope within you. So for this point, this second part of the verse, we're going to look at these four points as why you should be a Christian theist. So this first argument, the beginning of the universe, goes as follows: that everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe had a beginning. The universe, therefore, has a cause. Now, the law of causality states that everything that has a beginning has a cause. Notably, it does not say everything that exists has a cause. So, as a little side note, that answers the "who created God" question. Because if God didn't have a beginning, he didn't have a cause. So Richard Dawkins actually wrote a book called The God Delusion. The entire premise of that is, if God created the universe, well, who created that God? Well, who created that God? And you go infinitely into the past. But Aristotle observed that you can't have an infinite number of causes into the past. At some point, you have to hit an eternal, uncaused first cause, or as he put it, the unmoved mover. And for us, that is God. And to establish the second premise, the late famous atheist Stephen Hawking said, "Almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning, And cosmologist Alexander Vilenkin would say at Hawking's 70th birthday party, all, not some, of the evidence says that the universe had a beginning. Since we established the first two premises, the logical conclusion in the third point follows. But more importantly, it's what's the implication of the cause? What's the description of the cause? And a skeptic might say, wait, you're going too fast. Slow down a little bit. You know? Just give science more time. Science will find a natural explanation for the universe. But it's funny because there will never be a natural explanation for the cause of the universe. Why? Because nature can't be the cause of nature. You need something outside of nature, something super nature, or supernatural, if you will. We can deduct, therefore, if space, time, and matter had a beginning, the cause of the universe must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. Immaterial simply means a spirit being. If I have the right slide, yes. So that corroborates what John says, that God is spirit and we worship him in spirit and in truth. This also fits with Genesis 1:1, the very first verse in the Bible. In the beginning, time, God created the heavens, space, and the earth, matter. So uncoincidentally, the Bible corroborates philosophy and cites God as the cause. Furthermore, we can establish that this cause of the universe is extremely enormously powerful. He has to have the ability to create the universe. He has to be personable in order to decide to create the universe. He has to be intelligent to know how to create the universe. And he has to be singular. Because he's timeless, he's an infinite being, there can only be one infinite being. And that's a philosophical thing I'm not going to get into. Now, when you think about something that is spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent, and singular, who else comes to mind but God? To show you just how intelligent that this cause of the universe is, we're going to look into a little bit of the fine-tuning of the universe. Prominent atheists such as Stephen Hawking and Richard Dawkins admit that the universe appears to be finely tuned. Richard Dawkins would say this is the strongest evidence for God. Hawking said that if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in 100,000 million million, 1 second after the Big Bang, the universe would have either collapsed back in on itself or never developed galaxies. This can't be explained by some guess-and-check cosmic evolution that natural selection just found its way out. The expansion rate of the universe just happened to be perfectly right there in the beginning. Another example of this is gravity. If the force of gravity were off by one part in 10 to the 40, our sun would not exist. How big is one part in 10 to the 40? On a scale of the width of the known universe, that's 1 inch. Now, obviously, those odds are astronomical, 1 inch on the scale of the entire known universe. But you don't need just the force of gravity to be right. You need about a dozen other physical things. And so when you need them all to hit, it becomes virtually impossible. So there's essentially three options to explain this apparent fine-tuning: chance, physical necessity, or intelligent design. I don't have enough faith to believe that these extreme degrees of precision just happened like this by some unknown, unintelligent means called chance. The universe could have had physical necessities that were different. Therefore, the most logical conclusion to the apparent fine-tuning of the universe is that it was intelligently designed. Now, so we've had established that this cause of the universe is singular, personal, powerful, intelligent, spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. And if you'll be here Wednesday night, we'll talk a little bit more about morality. If I made the argument from morality, we can also establish that this being is extremely moral and cares about our morality. But we can't establish that this is the Christian God yet. We'd be getting too far ahead of ourselves. For that, we have to look at the happenings to Jesus of Nazareth. So the following is a minimal facts argument for the resurrection of Christ, meaning it only uses facts that are accepted by skeptic scholars. These scholars don't believe the Bible. They don't believe any of that. But yet they accept that these things transpired in the first century. And I kind of have it with this acronym. It's not very bright, but it's ALIVE. I should have picked a different color. And so these things, even skeptics agree, happened. That a death by crucifixion, we get this from Roman historians like Tacitus and such, that ladies discovered Jesus' tomb empty. This is significant because women weren't trusted as being good for testimony back then. Independent appearances of Jesus alive after his death. Leading German New Testament critic Gerd Ludemann said, quote, "It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ." Now, historians won't try to explain what those things are. They'll back off that. But they accept that the disciples at least thought they saw the risen Jesus after he died. Number four is violence endured by the apostles. This is confirmed by seven first century sources, and Paul writes his own list in 2 Corinthians 11, how he was shipwrecked, beaten, whipped. He was in danger from people and the elements. He went on to be beheaded in Rome. And he's just one example of the disciples' suffering. He went from a prominent place in Judaism to a basically homeless person on the run in Christianity. Number five, the enemies of Christ are converted. James, the brother of Jesus, who did not believe Jesus was the Messiah while he was alive, or even when he died, for some reason flipped that script after Jesus' supposed resurrection. And the only good explanation for that is that he saw Jesus alive and was convinced. And then Paul also went from the persecutor to the persecuted. And that was after he claimed to have an experience with the risen Jesus. Now, I didn't spend too much time establishing these. I could spend a whole sermon establishing these, but that would bore you. And I don't need to, because skeptics already accept these facts. Obviously, so then the question becomes, what event best explains all of these things happening? And so obviously the resurrection perfectly explains all five of these facts. But there are some common naturalistic theories that skeptics have used to try and get around and explain away the resurrection, such as the swoon theory, that Jesus didn't really die. He only appeared dead. He didn't really rise. He just got a little better over 3 days. That Jesus had a twin, which is quite unbelievable. The hallucination theory. This is the most popular theory by people who are willing to throw out a theory, is that just people mass hallucinated and thought they saw the risen Jesus. Then you have the wrong tomb theory, where the disciples discovered him in the wrong tomb. You have the missing body theory, where the body of Jesus was thrown into a mass grave and wasn't really thrown into a tomb. Then the conspiracy theory, which is the one that goes back to the first century, is the one that was in the Jews' mouths, saying the disciples stole the body. Now, will any of these sufficiently explain away the resurrection? No. For example, the swoon theory, that Jesus didn't really die, is refuted by facts 1, 3, and 4. If he just is on the verge of death, barely alive man, that certainly doesn't inspire the apostles to turn around and endure violence. The twin theory, there's absolutely no historical grounding that Jesus had a twin. These are people who traveled with Jesus for 3 years every day. They would be able to tell his twin apart, and his twin's grave would still have a body in it. So for the mass hallucination theory, multiple people on multiple different occasions doesn't fit mass hallucination. The definition of hallucination is also that it's in your head. If I'm seeing something, I say, "Rick, do you see that too?" And Rick sees it, that means it's reality. But if I'm only seeing it, then I'm hallucinating. So that falls apart. The wrong tomb theory is refuted because it doesn't explain the appearances of Jesus after his death, as well as the missing body theory and the conspiracy theory. None of those manage to explain how people saw Jesus alive after his death. It is such to the point that skeptics like Bart Ehrman, who teaches at UNC Chapel Hill, will tell his students, don't pick a naturalistic theory, don't pick and defend one, because they'll tear you apart with the evidence. And I want to go through three critics, how they react to this, because you don't realize how good this historical evidence is until you hear what they say about it. So people like Bart Ehrman will say, the most important single reason we shouldn't believe Jesus rose is because miracles shouldn't be believed even if they really happened. I'm not making this up. This is his position. They shouldn't be believed even if they really happened. People like David Hume, he lived in the 1700s, but he's quoted by all the modern guys. He says the resurrection didn't happen not because he has a better naturalistic explanation of these things, but because in his mind, miracles are impossible, period. So no matter what the evidence is, we deny the resurrection. And one more, Sam Harris, this is a direct quote. "Even if you had more evidence, whatever the evidence, it doesn't matter. Evidence doesn't matter. You shouldn't believe it. Miracles don't exist." Now, you'll notice a common presupposition within these prominent, leading, reasonable thinkers, right? And for them to be, you know, open-minded followers of evidence, or at least their claim to be, that's not very open-minded of them to rule out one possibility before even looking into it all. Now, of course, to their credit, if you sit down and say, okay, originally, what's the least likely option? That a man came back from the dead. That just doesn't happen, okay? But when you start looking at the evidence, you have to conclude that that might be the most logical option. For example, I heard William Lane Craig put it this way, that if a wife is murdered, the least likely suspect would probably be her husband because they're husband and wife. You know, why would a husband kill his wife? But then when you start examining the DNA and the fingerprints and it starts pointing to him, you're like, oh, wait a minute. The least likely suspect might actually be what happened. And since we can have this hope, that or assurance rather, that Jesus really did rise from the dead, let me tie this back to 1 Peter 3:15, giving a defense of the hope within. The hope within is that we get to be raised with Christ because of his resurrection. Without the resurrection, we have nothing. But with the resurrection, we are raised with him. And as I was putting this sermon together, I was trying to find a powerful and an emotional way to convey how we get to be raised with Jesus and how awesome a thing that is. And I decided I couldn't do it very well. And I figured that there's no better person to do that for me than God. So I would like to read you four verses that are powerfully striking to me of how we get to be raised with Christ. Romans 6, 4 and 5. Therefore, we have been buried with him through baptism into death, so that as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in newness of life. For if we have become united with him in the likeness of his death, certainly we shall be also in the likeness of his resurrection. Romans 8, 11. But if the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised Christ Jesus from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies. 1 Corinthians 6:14. Now God has not only raised the Lord, but will also raise us through his power. And 1 Peter 1:3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Now when we have this hope that an assurance that because Christ was raised, we also get to be raised, that's a pretty inspiring thing. And that's the same thing that inspired the apostles to go and endure the violence that they endured. And when we are inspired like that, that's a life-changing thing. And when our life is changed like that, people begin to ask, which leads me to my next point of giving the defense to those who ask. For this, we're going to look at two points for this. The first being living in such a way that people ask about the hope within us and answering those questions with adequacy. First, our lives are being changed is a testimony of the Spirit's operation within our lives. That itself is a testimony of God's existence and was the last point that I had for God's existence up there in the beginning. So for 1 Peter 3:15 says to give a defense to those who ask. This implies that we are living in such a way that people are going to see that and ask, that we're changed, that we're living so drastically different from society that people are going to say, you know, what's different about him? And if we're being joyful and hopeful, they're like, I'm gonna want to be a part of that. And this isn't to be, you know, in a I'm a Christian, I'm more morally upright than you, look at me kind of thing. But it's just something that naturally outflows from a changed life. And I believe Jesus put on a good example of this in Matthew 9, 10, and 11, which reads, then it happened that as Jesus was reclining at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, why is your teacher eating with the tax collectors and sinners? Now, was it a common thing to eat with the tax collectors and sinners? Or was it something that the religious elite, that the Pharisees did? No. So the religious elite of that day were not living in such a way that people looked at them and said, why are you eating with the tax collectors and sinners? Why are you doing something different? But Jesus did, and he did it on multiple occasions. He would do it later with Zacchaeus as well. Oftentimes, as Christians, we may puff our chest out and say, you know, I'm not going to associate with that person, or I'm more worthy and deserving. But maybe we need to be more like Jesus, and in this case, not be afraid to be associated with the lowly, and not act like a snobby religious elite, but live a life in such a way that people ask, why are you doing what you're doing? And then you are prompted to give a defense of why you're doing what you're doing. Just as the Pharisees asked Jesus why he was doing what he was doing. So oftentimes, however, the Pharisees were trying to trap Jesus. They weren't genuinely asking. And for that, the very next verse, 1 Peter 3:16, says, those who slander us and despise us for our good behavior will be put to shame. So don't lose heart. The second part of this is being able to answer those who ask with adequacy. This requires an extensive study and knowledge of not only the apologetic side of things, but the Word of God and having a life that is consistent with its teachings. To quote commentator Guyon Woods on this, it is said that every citizen in the city of Athens was expected to keep himself sufficiently informed in civic affairs to be able to participate intelligently in any discussion thereof. In the same way, Christians should be equally well informed in the things of God and just as skillful in their presentation. Christians must always be able to adequately respond to questions from many points of view in many areas, whether it be a different religion or an atheist or somebody within this own congregation. And this requires us to be consistently studying and growing. The last point I'm going to make, the last part of this verse, is doing all of this with gentleness and reverence. Part of responding to people who ask is not responding to people who are scoffers. A lot of times, if you get into discussions, they're not at looking for sincere answers and honest inquiry. They just want to scoff at you and make fun of you. And that just gets into heated and foolish and vain arguments that don't do any good and certainly are not gentle or reverent. And there's always a time to dust your shoes off and move along, as Jesus would say. And he would also say to those people who may act like that towards you, to love them, to do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who mistreat you. No matter how aggravated, violent, or upset your opposition may be, we have an obligation as God-fearing people to do good by them, bless them, love them, and pray for them while acting in gentleness and reverence. Now, does this have relevance to the abortion issue that's going on in this country right now? Absolutely. Unless you've been living under a rock, if you've watched the news or been on social media at any point during the past couple days, you've seen harsh arguments from both sides of the aisle. And none of those are very gentle or reverent. And as Christians, we're commanded to defend what is right, but we're also commanded to keep our composure and act with gentleness and reverence and maturity and not involve ourselves in foolish arguments. As for those, however, who are truly seeking inquiry, we can present a case to them with gentleness and reverence, which is also translated meekness and fear. This defense should be made with these qualities. Christians should justify their position with reason and logic, not with pride or arrogance, but with humbleness, an attitude free of scorn and haughtiness or bitterness, and a terror towards God and of the judgment, so that we keep ourselves in line. And this isn't to be, this defense isn't in a shove it down your way, I'm right, Christianity's true kind of thing. Or even when somebody who disagrees with a doctrine that you might believe, such as Rick and I, it's not a, this is what it says, I'm right. It's, as Dad will always tell me, when I see this verse, I can't get around this. What do you do with this? And there's a certain way where we can present our words and phrase them in a certain tone that we can speak with that will be gentle and reverent. So hopefully breaking down these four parts of 1 Peter 3:15 helped you a little bit better to grow in sanctifying Jesus as Lord in your heart. Maybe it gave you a little bit more information on how to give a defense and to those who ask and how to handle those who ask with gentleness and reverence. Hopefully this will have helped you fulfill two of Jesus' commands given in this verse, to give a defense with gentleness and reverence, and to live your life for Christ joyfully with such hope that people see that and want to be a part of it. Of course, the hope is getting to partake in the resurrection with Jesus. And the prerequisite to this is partaking in the likeness of his death. According to Romans 6, this is done in baptism as we are buried underwater into his death and we rise up out of that water in eternal life. If you have not been joined with the Lord in his resurrection through baptism, won't you now come as we stand and sing?